The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order Higher Education Finance and Policy. Members, we're going to continue where we left off on Monday with the Office of Higher Education. And Ms. Grimes, welcome again to the committee. And if you'd identify yourself for the record and then tell us where you're going to start.
Mr. Chairman, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. And I'm going to start with slide 21, in the one that has kind of a, this is kind of a cover that says post-secondary education.
Are you in, which one are you in? Which?
It's the other one. It's the one that has more of a beigey green front. It says post-secondary education in Minnesota.
All right. So all right. Slide 21?
Slide 21. All right, we were talking about average cumulative debt and so forth, and sort of the end of the slides on debt is that one other consideration when talking about debt is default rates. As we said, 87% of student loans in Minnesota are federal, and the federal government produces something called a cohort default rate, which tracks students for from the time they were supposed to begin student loan repayment for the next 2 years. And you can see from these data where the arrows are points to the Minnesota data. And these data show that even though Minnesota students borrow more than students in our peer states and nationally, our default rates are lower. And in particular, if you look at the private for-profit group, Minnesota default rate is 6.6%, and the national default rate for private for-profits is 12.9%. So we're just a little bit more than half of the national rate when it comes to that sector. The federal government is in the process of transitioning to three-year default rates, feeling that that gives them a little bit more complete picture. And those numbers show exactly the same pattern for Minnesota. Our Minnesota's three-year default rate is 9% overall, and but it has the same relationship to the national and the sector data. So I'm going to move along, if that's all right, with Mr. Chairman.
Proceed.
And now we're going to talk a little bit about Minnesota high school graduate projections, college readiness, college participation, enrollment trends, and characteristics of college students. This chart and the next one look at numbers of high school, or this chart looks at the, and the next one look at numbers of high school graduates. The number for recent years peaked in 2010 at 65,000 high school graduates statewide. The Minnesota Demographic Center projects a decline in the number of high school graduates of 1 to 3% each year through 2017. After that, the number is projected to increase 1.1 to 2% each year through 2023. And I just might note, of course, this is statewide. Some regions are having steeper declines, and some other school districts are having growth in their number of high school graduates.
For members who have come in, we're on page 23, or slide 23, I guess. And it is the post-secondary education in Minnesota, March 4th, 2013, packet. Is Representative Norton.
Could I just ask for clarification, Mr. Chair? Ms. Grimes, could you tell me on the, are these hard numbers of graduates or as a percent of the population of students going to school? Because this graph might simply be showing how many representative of how many students are actually going to school in those given years, and we do know that during the baby boom peaks there's more students in school, therefore there would be more graduates. So I'm looking for what's significant about this, not just the hard number, but what percent of the students that are actually in school are graduating, and I don't think this reflects that.
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, you're correct. This is just high school graduates. We'll get to how many of them participate in post-secondary education in just a couple of slides, if you can bear with me until there. But this is just high school graduates, and the actual shows exactly how many there were from the projected line over shows the projection, the demographer's projection of how many there will be going forward. Then on slide 24, it looks at the fact that the growth in Minnesota high school graduates is happening in students of color. The number of high school graduates or students of color is projected to grow by 4,700 in the next 13 years. And during the same period, the number of white graduates is projected to decline by 12%, which is 6,500 students. So the growth is happening in the students of color. And then there is a gap in preparedness coming out of high school. This is this chart shows proficiency, the percent with proficiency on the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment test in math in grade 11, and how that varies by race. In Minnesota Measures, there's also a chart that shows that for low-income students, namely those that got free or reduced-price lunch while in K-12 education, and for special ed students and for students who change schools during the year, the levels of proficiency are much lower than they are for students who are more middle income. Then here's the slide on the percent of high school graduates who attend college after high school. It's 69% overall. About 50% go straight from high school to a Minnesota college, and then we pick up another 15 to 20% that go to out of state to school.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're on high school graduates, just to convey a comments that were made to me from my Ridgewater College in Hutchinson that were a concern. They said so many of their high school graduates, I believe it's between 30 and 40%, need remedial English and math when they attend the college. Is that pretty much the same all across the all across the board, or are they experiencing a higher percentage than other colleges are when they come in?
Chairman,
Ms. Grimes.
Representative Greenhagen. The MinSCU and the University of Minnesota are legislatively mandated to do a report on remedial education every second year, and I believe that it's 38% overall of new entering students that need to take some remedial class.
Representative Greenhagen.
So do these students that come out of our high schools, 38%, and that's of the ones that decide to go on to college, are they, is there a charge for those classes? Who is picking up the cost? Is it the student or the college, or how's that cost being paid up for those remedial classes which they should have learned in their K-12 educational experience?
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, in my understanding, it is largely that the courses are charged tuition the same as they would be if they were a credit-bearing class, but most of the developmental education classes do not give credit that counts toward a degree.
Representative Greenhagen.
Yeah. Do you see any type of solution? I think it seems like a relatively high percentage, and unfortunately then the cost of these courses are being tied to their borrowing. And to me, it's a indicative that the K-12 system they came out of didn't meet their need. Okay, rather than say they failed them, I'm going to say it didn't meet their need in terms of having them become proficient in English and math, at least at a level where they could operate in at a college level. What's the solution? Is that an acceptable percentage, and we should just move on, or do you think it should? You know, what do other states experience? What would you say would be an acceptable percentage, if anything? Just appreciate your thoughts on that.
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, there is an initiative that Commissioner Casilius and Chancellor Rosenstone and Larry Kogelmiller, Director of our office, have to try to redesign the transition from high school to college and to try to give the students the kind of assessments and help while they're in high school that would help reduce the need for remedial education as time goes on. I'm sorry, I don't know how we compare to other states in that particular indicator.
Representative Greenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you think that's an acceptable percentage, though? Do you think it should be quite a bit lower, or what are your...
Mr. Chairman, I
Ms.
believe
Grimes.
Everyone thinks that it should be lower.
Okay, that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenhagen.
Yeah, it just seems, you know, unreasonably high as far as I'm concerned, considering the fact that they were 12 years in a system and they can't do the basic... math and reading. And I'm not saying there can't be exceptions to that. Obviously, we know a certain percentage are going to need help. I'll just pass this along. When I was first on the school board, my superintendent, somebody introduced at the state legislature a bill that caused a lot of angst in my superintendent at that time. And it was a bill that said that when a student goes on to college, if they need remedial in math, it should be charged back to the K-12 high school or K-12 public school system. He didn't sit still for quite a few days as that bill was. I don't know how far it got, but I know that gave him a lot of angst. And, you know, sometimes there has to be a penalty or a consequence when you have when there's a failure or a problem in the system. I mean, and I don't want to apply education necessarily to making cars or whatever, but I think if we looked at a private manufacturer and they had a manufacturing plant and 38% of what was coming out of that plant was defective and unusable, I think there'd be some real fast changes made in a hurry, because that's just simply unacceptable at the private level. I mean, companies go out of business with that type of percentage. So to the degree that you can help us formulate or give us some input on how to address that, and obviously that adds to student debt, I'd sincerely appreciate it. I think the committee probably would, too.
Representative Bruenhagen, I believe the provision you were alluding to was proposed by Senator Pogemiller in a school aides bill. You may recall the name.
Yeah, it's vaguely familiar. At least he's on a path where there has to be a consequence, Mr. Chair. Right now we have no consequence.
You may want to hang on to that thought, because I think Senator or Director Pogemiller will be back this week.
Okay.
No. Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to Representative Grunhagen's comments, a couple of things, and I'm not sure which chart you're actually on, but if you are talking about math and English, there are deficits for students. I work as a college counselor. I see a lot of these students who are testing. So one issue is the assessment that's given. Is the assessment actually truly the right assessment? We haven't in the past had the right alignment, I don't think, between what the assessment is that they are taking for entry into the college and what they have actually, the assessment they are taking as they're exiting the high school. So that's one issue. And so we don't compare apples to apples with that. Another is that they're tested on English and reading and math, and I would challenge every one of us to perhaps take the math assessment at the college level, because I would say we would all find that we're deficient in that area, because we don't necessarily do algebra on a daily basis. But reading, definitely, that's an area that we need to be concerned about. And another is just that I'm not sure if you have the recent graduates versus those that have been out of school for a period of time, because that, too, would be something that, we're putting everybody together, and some of those are, yes, they graduated in June, they're coming to the college in August, and others are, they've been out for a number of years.
Representative Grunia.
Oh, just Representative Hoppe, appreciate those comments. And, I'm not saying any of us could pass those tests. We probably couldn't. But that's why we became legislators, okay?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms.
Representative Hoppe, I just might follow up that mandated report is on students who are within 2 years of having left high school. Thank you.
Representative Swedinski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We kind of touched a little bit about 38%, and we don't understand quite where we maybe stand nationally when it comes to remedial classes, but just trying to get a little handle on where we sit when it comes to the financial burden to taxpayers when it comes to remedial classes. Do we have a rough idea when, these 38% of students that are taking remedial courses, how many remedial courses are they taking? Are they taking one to get to where they need to be? Are they taking three? Are they taking five? And then, kind of extrapolating that out across the board and looking at what's the total cost when it comes to higher education to do remedial coursework to get students where they should be when we're looking at the whole picture.
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to suggest that perhaps the committee might want to hear from Minstein University of Minnesota about the remedial education report at some point in time, because there's quite a bit of information in there. The 38%, I believe, is students who have one or more remedial courses that they need to take.
Ms. Fergus?
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Meredith Fergus. I'm a policy analyst at the Office of Higher Education. We have been analyzing more of that data within the state longitudinal data system, and I believe when we were doing some data testing, we ran that exact question, and we found that students on average were taking 5 credits during their fall term, so somewhere between 1 and 2 classes. We haven't looked at that data long term, though. That was just students who entered in the fall term, but it is data analysis that we plan to expand upon within SLEDS.
Thank you. All right. Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to comment, I guess, on Representative Grunhagen's comments. I think my senator was also involved in that whole discussion dealing with charging back to the public school if there was a failure on their part, supposedly, to educate the kids. And it didn't go too far, but it did send a message. And I'm generally trying to think in simple terms, if I can, most of the time. And I'm just wondering if our public education system fails to put enough emphasis on what college is going to require. As a student, I remember taking things pretty casually sometimes. So maybe we need to just ramp it up a little bit so the kids know what's ahead of them in time for them to maybe apply themselves. And I've got grandkids that I've seen go through the same process. Eventually, the light goes on. That's all I have to say.
Ms. Grimes, you want to
Mr. proceed? Chairman, turning to post-secondary enrollment on slide 27, the enrollment data here in your packet is fall headcount enrollment. Now, some of the data that you saw from the University of Minnesota and Minsk, you talked about full-time equivalent students. This is headcount. This is a way of counting everybody who's there in the fall and what kind of a student they are. It's everybody who gets served. And you can see that over the time period we're looking at here, there's been a relatively rapid increase in enrollment at two-year institutions, in part because of recession and need for retraining. And that has been true in both the green line, which is the public two-year institutions, and the gold line, which is the private career schools. So that kind of shows what, and then enrollment has declined a little bit last fall and the fall before as the economy started to get better. And slide 28 shows enrollment by sector and level. The pink parts of the bar are undergraduates. The blue parts are high school students in every sector except the private career schools. Those are post-secondary enrollment option students, and the post-secondary enrollment option students may be attending in college and the schools in their high school. They may be attending online, or they may be leaving their high school to go to a college campus to take the post-secondary enrollment options. At the private career schools, the few high school students there are in special programs offered by those schools. And in your packet, pages 1 through 7 have detail by institution if you want it. In the packet that says higher education on the front, it looks like this. If you wanted more detail to look at campus by campus, what enrollment was, it is there. In terms of PSEO enrollment, campuses of note are Southwest State University, the University of Minnesota Crookston, and Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, which all have 38% or more of their undergraduate headcount are high school students.
Ms. Grimes, is that a concern that those numbers are so high?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't say it's a concern. It's just something that we noticed in the data. Those are not undergraduates who are eligible for financial aid, for example, when they are high school students.
Ms. Grimes, your office hasn't had any concerns raised over recruitment by certain higher ed institutions for post-secondary options?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I would call it concerns. We have had people comment to us that, for example, Southwest State University is quite entrepreneurial in offering its services to help a high school offer a low-demand class either through college in the schools or online.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, this is, Mr. Chair, a very complicated topic, and having served in K-12 and on a school board, I can talk about the financial challenges as well as whether it's a plus or a minus. And I think depending on what seat you're in, you might view it a little bit differently. Post-secondary options started as a way, just exactly as Ms. Grimes stated, a way for students who couldn't get a class in their area to be able to access some higher level or unique courses that weren't offered. And it now has turned into a way to get kids through college on this state K-12 type dime. and move them along quicker and get them out of high school. And I myself and many of you, I'm sure, have known students who graduate from high school with either a two-year degree or a certificate or two of their 4 years of college done, and that's becoming more and more prevalent. And I would say it's become this legislature's a push from this legislative body over the past couple of years to do such. I personally am one that would rather see kids spend more time in high school and with rigorous curriculum, and would argue that in some schools the curriculum is more rigorous in the high school than it is in some of the community colleges. But having said all that, I just would mention that there are some school districts who, and I believe perhaps even in the Winona area, who have made arrangements that the money that the K-12 system puts into the schools is used, and I mention this because it addresses some of the issues that were made earlier, and set aside for remediation. Because sometimes there is more money set aside, or there's more money, rather than an excess of money going to the colleges, the excess in the tuition is set aside for remediation, and Rochester Public Schools has such a contract, and there are several others around the state. So there are some positive things that are coming out of that money that's going to PSEO as well, and it does deal with remediation. And I'll get off my soapbox.
There were other concerns raised, though, too, and they have been about, you called it entrepreneurial. I called it recruitment as a way to increase enrollment, and we'll save this for another discussion, but there have been concerns raised. All right, proceed.
Mr. Chairman, slide 29 looks at enrollment by whether the students were enrolled full-time or part-time. Minsky two-year colleges are those that have most of the part-time undergraduates, and most undergraduates attending four-year institutions are enrolled full-time. And again, details by institution on part-time enrollment are on pages 25 through 38 in your packet if you want to know enrollment for a particular institution in your district or so forth.
Ms. Grimes, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Grimes, looking at the part-time students, can you tell me whether they're taking one class, two classes, or are they working just to be able to take a class because tuitions are high?
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, probably all of the above. The definition of part-time here is that it's less than 75% of whatever the institution considers to be a full-time load. So there is a mix here. As we get into the state grant program, there is more information by credit about how many students are taking how many credits.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And those part-time students that are working, I know we're going to get into it later, but did they get any grant money?
Ms. Grimes?
Mr. Chairman, in some cases they do, in other cases they don't, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that more as we get into the state grant program.
All right.
Then we are seeing an increase in undergraduates of color. This is slide 30. Undergraduates for students of color have increased by 10 percentage points just during the past decade. And then slide 31 looks at undergraduate enrollment by age. One of the things that sometimes gets said these days is that the younger generation will be less educated than the older generation. This is not true in Minnesota. If you look at the line of the 20 to 24 year olds, you can see that there are many of them enrolled, and also the 25 to 34 year olds have recently had a rather substantial increase in their enrollment. I'm sorry, I went the wrong way.
Ms. Grimes, 1 second, please. Representative Swizzle.
Mr. Chair, this red line, would you say that somewhat accurately represents the PSEO students, or what percentage of that red line would you say is that?
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, that would include 18 and 19-year-olds who would not necessarily be PSEO students. I believe on our website we have some more information about those who are younger than 18, and I could get back to you on that.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Proceed.
Then another thing we get asked is what percentage of our enrollment is non-resident? And the interesting thing here is that in the last decade, while the number of undergraduate enrollment has increased, the percent that are non-residents has been very steady. It's been 15 to 16% the whole decade. And then this is another slide. This may speak partly to Representative Swedzinski's question. This looks at the number of students who are concurrently enrolled. And again, this is PSEO students in its broadest definition. It includes those who leave high school to go to a college campus, as well as those who take college in the schools and those who take online classes at the post-secondary level while they are in high school.
Representative Swedzinski.
Just moving back to slide 32, that 15%, have you seen a difference between, I mean, undergraduates from non-resident students? That 15%, do you have a breakdown of international students versus, like, you know, Wisconsin, South Dakota, you know, that kind of a breakdown when it comes to out-of-state tuition? And because that was a conversation that was held earlier with the U of M and the percentages of when we're going out and that's displacing students from the state and that sort of thing.
Ms. Grimes. Many of the foreign students are at the graduate level, but we do have information. A large part of the non-resident enrollment in Minnesota is tuition reciprocity students who are coming from Wisconsin or North or South Dakota. And there are Minnesota students who flow the other way, of course. But we can get you that information about the undergraduates.
Ms. Grimes, and there would be some campuses that would have a much higher percentage of those students on the border.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Much higher.
Border institutions tend to have higher percentages of non-residents enrolled.
Right.
Now we're going to look a little bit at graduation rates, degrees conferred, and a little bit about post-secondary attainment in the adult population from census data. Slide 35 is graduation rates. These are for the four-year institutions, so you can see that it shows both four- and six-year graduation rates. And they have been increasing, especially at the University of Minnesota campuses. And detail by institution, again, if you want to know that, is starts on page 70 of your packet that says House Higher Education House Hearing, and it's kind of a thick packet that you have. There is a little bit of a limitation to these data. They follow cohorts of students who start out as full-time, first-time students, and they follow them for 4 and 6 years and see what percent of them have graduated. In the future, the U.S. Department, this is U.S. Department of Education data, and in the future, they will be using a broader definition of the cohort, and there will be a broader, but those statistics are not yet available. So these are the four-year institutions, and these are the two-year institutions. The rates here include those who received certificate or associate degrees and those who transferred to another institution, since many students start at a two-year institution with the intention of transferring. So you can see the three-year graduation rates, and then you can see the three-year graduation plus transfer rate. And so in total, the three-year graduation rate for Minnesota is 29%, but if you also include the students who transfer, that's 55%. And there is more detail on graduation rates in your packet. Turning to degrees students earn. Slide 37 shows over time, over the last decade, the number of bachelor's degrees, associate certificates, and doctorates and master's degrees students have received. The light blue line with the squares on it is bachelor's degrees. And Minnesota students receive more bachelor's degrees than any other type of degree. The purple line with circles on it is the certificates that are below a bachelor's degree, and the blue line with diamonds on it is the associate degree recipients. And then the green line with triangles is master's degrees. And then the number of students getting doctorates has crept up gradually over time, but not as much as
Ms. Grimes, excuse me, Representative Norton has a question.
I just have a technical question. On associate degree, is that a conferred degree or students that just went and completed 2 years of education at a two-year, say, Rochester Community Technical College?
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, these are the ones that actually received an associate degree, either an associate in applied sciences or a regular associate degree. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there four-year colleges that confer the associate degree? And do you know which ones those would be?
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppe, I do not. I know that there has been some that have talked about it, and that this might be a question for Minsky because they have a particular initiative going on to try to get students to come back and get a degree.
Sorry, Ms. Fergus, you want
to? Representative Poppe. Yes, probably the most common one that comes to mind is St. Kate's University. They offer both associate degrees as well as bachelor's degrees. So there are a number of universities that do. I don't have a list off the top of my head, though.
Okay, again, details by institution are in page 73 of your packet. So if you want to know how many degrees are being awarded by a given institution, that information is available there. Then one of the other questions that we sometimes get is, what are students majoring in when they get their degrees? And slide 38 is a look at among bachelor's degrees conferred, what were the students majoring in? And you can see that by far the most common major is business. The second in recent years has been the science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM disciplines. And third, which recently overtook liberal arts, are degrees in the health sciences. Whereas liberal arts degrees have been declining in recent years, and then you can see the other less common categories there.
With government at the bottom? Okay.
Government at the bottom, yes. Okay. Then slide 39 looks at attainment in the overall adult population in Minnesota. Now, this is census data, and so it includes people who moved to Minnesota who already had a degree, those who may have gotten their education in a reciprocity state, as well as those who grew up here and got a degree here. And this is another place where you can see that we do not see the younger generation is, in fact, turning out to be more educated than the older generation. The red line is the 25 to 34-year-olds. The green line is the 35 to 44-year-olds, and the blue line is the 45 to 64-year-olds. And Minnesota ranks second in the nation, just behind Massachusetts, on the percent of the population that has an associate's degree or higher. However, when it comes to attainment, this is another place where we see the gaps in attainment between racial and ethnic population groups. Asians and whites have the highest attainment levels, and population groups of color do not have as high of attainment levels.
Rep. Sam Norton.
Since you're here, and I think you have this information, with regard to the Native American or American Indian population, with the degrees, it's been my understanding that there's considerable scholarship funds available for this population, both through I think some of the casino revenue funds as well as just state appropriations. And so I guess I'm a little surprised it's this low. I know they're also a population that has struggled with success in high school as well, so there may be a correlation there of graduating and moving on. But is there,
Mr. Chairman,
am I misinformed? I might be.
With your permission, Megan Fitzgibbon from our office runs our American Indian Scholarship Program, and she knows more in this area than I do.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Megan Fitzgibbon from the Office of Higher Education. I'm the manager of state scholarship programs. Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, our office does administer the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program, which provides scholarships to American Indians who are Minnesota residents. And the tribes in Minnesota do also offer scholarships to their members, and but those combined, the first thing to remember is that the tribes only, a majority of them only provide scholarships to students who are members of their own tribe, and there are a number of American Indians in Minnesota who cannot be enrolled members of a tribe, or they're not from a Minnesota tribe. And again, you also pointed out the biggest reason why the lowest attainment is at the American Indian level is because they have the lowest, I believe, the lowest high school graduation rate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was asked to turn to talk a little bit about some federal issues. 89% of all the federal grant money received by Minnesota undergraduates comes from a program called Federal Pell Grants. And federal Pell Grants have increased substantially in recent years. In fiscal year 2007, 80,000 Minnesota undergraduates received $179 million, and in fiscal year 2011, 153,000 Minnesota students received $513 million in federal Pell Grants. There is an upcoming Pell Grant shortfall of $2 billion that will begin in the 2015-16 academic year, and this is because there was a five-year increase that was part of the federal stimulus, American Recovery and Reinvestment Act in 2009, and that 5 years will be over by the time we get to 15-16. Earlier projections was of a much higher shortfall, more in the $7 to $8 billion range, but enrollment is down a little bit nationwide as the economy has gotten better, and the federal government did do some things to trim eligibility for certain population groups. And so the most recent data released by the Congressional Budget Office about 3 weeks ago is for a smaller shortfall.
Ms. Grimes, can you explain the interaction of the Pell Grant to the state grant program? Or Ms. Fergus?
Mr. Chair, it's actually part of our next presentation for the state grant, but we do take the Pell Grant amount the student qualifies for as part of the state grant calculation. So we apply the state grant on top of the Pell Grant.
And you might want to, when you get to that part, take it a little slower so we really understand how those two interact. So, all right, proceed.
Mr. Chairman, then when it comes to federal sequestration, Pell Grants are not subject to sequestration. However, they are subject to annual appropriations, which I will get to in a minute, but let me stick to sequestration for the time being. Sequestration is expected to cause an increase in fees for federal student loans. The upfront fees for federal Stafford loans would probably increase from a little bit. It's basically about $3. I should have corrected that. $3 per borrower per year. And then for Parent PLUS loans, they're now saying it's going to be about $20 increase in fees for students. Then there are some other categories of federal financial aid. There's Federal Supplemental Education Opportunity Grants, affectionately known as FSEOG. 33,000 Minnesota undergrads received $21 million in 2011. They're now estimating that about 920 fewer students would receive the grants and about $775,000 fewer, less in awards under that FSEOG program. And work study is expected to have a decrease also. About 500 fewer students would have work study jobs, and there would be about 908,000 less in earnings. In both of these cases, the institutions have to match the federal funds with at least 25% of institutional funds. So the federal cutback is actually a little bit larger in terms of the awards that would go, because if the federal money there isn't there, the institutions can have to match it as well. There are also some programs that our office runs that would be affected by sequestration. Get Ready Gear Up is a program that works with low-income students in K-12 schools starting in middle school. We get $3.1 million in federal funds per year. I don't know for certain that the reduction would be $164,000, but overall the sequestration reduction is 5.3%, and that's what 5.3% would be. And it would result in reduced purchase of supplies. And then this is an area where the office has been making some grants out of those federal funds to low-income schools to encourage them to have science, technology, engineering, and math programs, and we would probably have to reduce those grants. Another area is something called College Access Challenge Grants. Again, this fosters activities to increase the number of underserved students prepared for post-secondary education. It's $1.5 million a year. This is another thing that was funded in the federal stimulus bill and may come to an end in the 15-16 academic year. A 5.3% reduction would be $80,000. One of the things this money gets used for is software to help extend the effort, the reach of high school counselors. The software does things like compile all the students' recommendations in one place, notify the students when recruiters are coming to the high school campus, help the student plan out what they need to take during high school, all the courses they need to take in high school in order to go to college, and so forth. And then we also get some money under a federal program called Improving Teacher Quality Grants. This is grants to 16 universities to provide professional development to teachers in core academic areas, including social studies and government. and a 5.3% reduction would be about $45,000. This program, the feds have been cutting back in this program the last few years. We've already reduced the size of the grants to institutions, and with this federal cutback, we will have to look into whether to make fewer grants to institutions or to, again, reduce the grants to the existing institutions. Okay, then the next fiscal deadline at the federal government level will be that the current continuing resolution providing appropriations to keep the federal government running expires on March 27th. And that includes funding for the federal Pell Grant for next year. There is scheduled a $95 increase in the maximum federal Pell Grant award from the current $5,550 to $55,645 for next year, but neither the base funding for federal Pell Grants nor that increase has yet been funded by Congress. And our plan was to now switch to a more detailed examination of the state grant program, unless there are questions.
Representative Johnson. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Smith.
Yes, just this question goes back to kind of the racial graduation rates. A few pages back, you may want to come up ahead. I forget what page it was on, but it talked about 8% of American Indians are graduating from college, and you said the reason behind that was they don't have as many people graduating from college. Do those numbers in that graph, when it comes to college graduation, reflect all the total population or just high school graduates?
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, this particular data that was on slide 40 is census data on adults in the population. So of all American Indian adults in the population, 18% have an associate degree or higher.
Okay, okay.
So, Ms. Grimes, this just isn't Minnesota, then. It's
this is national.
No, this is Minnesota.
This is
census,
all right.
Data,
okay.
About Minnesota.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 45, tell me a little bit more about the teacher quality grants, and is that professional development to teachers who are teaching or teachers that are learning to be teachers, or just to describe that a little bit, please.
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppy, this program is run by Nancy Walters on our staff, and my understanding is that it's professional development for teachers who are already teaching.
So my question kind of follows up a little bit with Representative Poppy's. So would that be, I know like in high needs areas, so like if you're a math or science teacher that is already going and teaching maybe in rural areas, would that have anything to do with that? Because I know there's some programs out there from the federal level, if you teach math or science for 5 years within one institution and one school district, then you get a percentage of your school loans repaid. Is that kind of what we're talking about? Or
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, this is really money that goes for a university or college to do professional development for existing teachers. There is federal loan forgiveness for teachers. Teachers who teach in Title I low-income serving schools are eligible for some federal loan forgiveness, and those who teach science, technology, engineering, and math are eligible for a larger amount of federal loan forgiveness. And then the U.S., starting in 2017, anyone who has worked for government at any level, local, state, federal, or a nonprofit, as long as they're not promoting religion, will be eligible for loan forgiveness after they've been paying on their federal loans for 10 years.
All right. So we're moving to which packet?
Mr. Chair, it's the blue and white packet entitled Minnesota State Grant.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, I just wanted to start out with a little background information on the Minnesota State Grant Program. The Minnesota State Grant Program is a need-based grant. Students apply for it by completing the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or the FAFSA. This is the same application that is used to determine students' eligibility for a federal Pell Grant. So it's one application. Minnesota state grants are, or Minnesota residents attending Minnesota institutions who are U.S. citizens or eligible non-citizens are eligible for a Minnesota state grant. And this would include both part-time and full-time students. So as long as they're taking 3 credits or more, they are eligible for a Minnesota state grant. If they are taking 1 credit or more, they are eligible for a federal Pell Grant. Last year, we awarded approximately $145 million to 83,000 students in Minnesota, and that represents about 1 out of every 3 undergraduates in Minnesota. We just wanted to also put up for your reference that Minnesota Statute 136A.095 states that it is the identification of men and women who are economically disadvantaged in the state and the encouragement of their educational development in eligible institutions of their choosing are in the best interests of the state and the students. That is the statute that we refer to when we're talking about the purpose of the Minnesota State Grant Program. So I'm afraid this is where I probably will start to get a little technical. So please interrupt me at any time. Usually Director Pogger Miller is sitting next to me and he always says, well now in English, this is what Meredith is talking about. So the Minnesota State Grant Program is based on a model that we refer to as the Design for Shared Responsibility. Essentially, we take the price of attendance for higher education in Minnesota and we divide it among 3 payers, students, families, and then taxpayers, both through the federal Pell Grant and the Minnesota State Grant Program. Essentially, we start by determining what the students' costs are. We do that by essentially looking at the cost that you establish in statute. The first one being the living and miscellaneous expense allowance, which is currently set in session law at $7,000 per year. And then we take the tuition and fees that is charged by the institution. The tuition and fees represented here are for the University of Minnesota, and those are capped at $10,488 currently in session law. The actual tuition fees at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities is $13,526. That additional $3,000 is considered to be 100% the responsibility of the student and the family because it is not part of the Minnesota State Grant formula. Mm-hmm. After we determine the student's cost, statute tells us that 46% of those costs are to be the responsibility of the student. It is assumed that the student will benefit from their education. So in terms of future income received, we expect that they will pay 46%. Or at the University of Minnesota, that is approximately $8,000. Secondly, we use the results that from the information submitted on the FAFSA, which is analyzed through the federal need analysis, to determine what the family can afford to contribute to the education. And this is a base. This is based upon...
Excuse me a second.
Representative Fitzsimmons.
Sorry to punch. I think we got the Representative Pulowski version. Ours has Winona State University on it.
Mr. Chair and members, I actually think we just have the wrong PowerPoint.
Oh, okay.
Because my packet too says Chair. Winona State.
Representative Fitzsimmons, I think this is the one there.
But Mr. Chair, the charts were different. We used the University of Minnesota for the Senate presentation.
Oh.
And then we switched it to Winona State for the House.
Well, that's very kind of you.
But it didn't get on the flash drive.
All right.
So if you're looking at the Winona State version, the tuition and fees at Winona State for next year will be approximately $8,983. And then the student responsibility is $7,352 is what you should see in the light blue. Families attending whose students are attending Winona State would be expected to pay approximately $8,600. If they attend the University of Minnesota, as is shown on this slide, they will be expected to pay about $9,400. It's an assessment based on their current income and assets. So an annual snapshot of income and assets from the information reported on the FAFSA, which is largely tax information. My apologies for the mix-up. This is where it gets interesting. We actually then, for the taxpayer responsibility, we take into account the federal Pell Grant. The federal Pell Grant will range up to $5,550. As Ms. Grimes spoke of, there is a small increase that's planned for but not funded for next year. And then what you have is you have the Minnesota State Grant applied on top of that. So the remainder portion up to the combined tuition fees plus living and miscellaneous expenses is the amount that the state grant would cover in the dark green.
All of these percent, all of these dollar amounts vary by the choice of institution the student chooses. So as the tuition fees go up for a student, if they choose a higher cost institution, they are required to pay a larger percentage of that cost. And then the remainder is picked up by the state and federal programs.
So on this slide, the relationship of the Pell Grant and the state grant is exactly what? If we use Director Pogemiller's terms.
In English?
Well, I would use it this way. Probably the simplest, the better.
Yeah. Essentially, if a student qualifies for both a Pell Grant and a state grant, for each dollar the Pell Grant goes up, the state grant goes down.
Yes.
For each dollar the Pell Grant goes down, the state grant goes up.
All right. And members, when we get to putting the bill together, that's a reminder for you. So that's how they interact. Representative Szczesinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question kind of goes back to kind of the international students portion. So if you kind of look at that blue portion of the slide, do they do asset analysis for international students as part of their combined tuition?
Ms. Ferguson.
International students typically don't qualify for a state grant. So are you thinking in terms of state and federal?
I guess I was thinking more in just total tuition paid, I guess, would be probably. Is there any sort of a sliding scale or anything like that when it comes to calculating international tuition, or it's all nothing like that? No.
Ms. Ferguson.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm actually not sure. I do know that institutional policies may vary on what the tuition fees charged for international students are. I know the University of Minnesota revised those policies in the last 5 years, but to the specifics, no, I do not know.
Okay, thank you.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, that was kind of the quick overview. So we just kind of wanted to walk through each of those component parts a little bit and give you a little history on where we were over the last 10 years, or where we've been over the last 10 years. So as I stated before, for the price component, for the recognized price of attendance, which is tuition fees and living expenses, those are set in session law. Statute does state that if the tuition fee amount is not capped within session law, it does revert back to the highest public tuition fees charged at a two-year or a four-year. That would currently be Dakota County Technical College, which is just approximately at $5,800, and the University of Minnesota Twin Cities at $13,526, so much higher than what is set in session law. In terms of the payments assignments, those are also set in law. The 46% ASR, as well as the assigned family responsibility, and then the remainder being the assigned taxpayer responsibility, or the federal and state. Federal Pell Grant and Minnesota State Grant. This is what the state grant formula actually looks like for calculating an award per student. So tuition fees plus the living and miscellaneous expenses is the budget. We then prorate that by the number of credits for which a student enrolled. So if they are enrolled at 12 credits, we then only take into account 75% of the cost for full-time students, or 80%, sorry, my math is off. From that prorated award calculation budget, we then subtract out the 46%, or the assigned student responsibility. We take out the assigned family responsibility, or that assessment of income and assets. Then we subtract out the Pell Grant the student qualifies for, and the remainder is the Minnesota State Grant. I happen to love math, so this is probably just really cool to me, so please interrupt at any time. The price components, these are the statutes that govern those price components for the cost of attendance. It's 136A, 121 subdivision 6, and I'll leave that to reference as needed. This is what we look at it visually, depending on which example you're looking at, Winona State or the University of Minnesota. This is what the tuition maximums currently would revert back to, that $13,526 and $5,623 at Dakota County. In addition, for the living and miscellaneous expense allowance, we benchmark those two three kind of external factors. We look at what the living and miscellaneous expenses are compared to inflation, compared to the federal poverty threshold, as well as the consumer expenditure survey, which I talked briefly on Monday. So visually, this is what those benchmarks look like. On the left in blue, you see the LME is currently set at $7,000 for next year. That compares to the poverty guidelines for a single person for 9 months of $8,378. And then the Consumer Expenditure Survey, which is that national survey of spending by 18 to 24-year-olds, at $12,869. On the right, you have the tuition fee maximum benchmark. In blue, we have the amounts that are set in session law. And then in red, we have the average tuition and fees charged by the various institutions. The public two-year college average, the state university average at $76.58, University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and then the private not-for-profit university average at just over $33,000. In terms of the tuition fee maximums over time, the next chart shows the bars represent the tuition fees charged by the various sectors, the private nonprofit 4 years, the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and then the Minsk State University average. And the red line represents that amount that was set in session law over time. It has increased gradually over time, however, not nearly the rate of tuition fees. The next part is to look at the payment assignment for students, and that is governed by 121 subdivision 5. The assigned student responsibility, or that percentage assessment we assign to students, it originally started at 50% when the program was first initiated back in 1983. That 50% stayed in law until actually 1993 when it was, or 1997-98 when it decreased to 47, then 46%. It currently stands at 46%. The kind of blip you see for 48.2, that was in fiscal year 2011 when we actually had a high demand for the program and we had to reduce awards to all students. Statute states that when we reduce awards to all students, the ASR is one of those parameters we increase so that we apply a reduction across the board.
We have a question from Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me a little bit, as the four-year cap goes up on these state grants, How does that work out as far as the allocation of money to, you know, some of the more expensive schools against some of the less expensive Minsky campuses? Does it reduce the amount of money available to the Minsky campuses?
Ms. Ferguson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no. For if you increase the dollar amount, provided there are available appropriations, students who are over the current cap but then become eligible for additional funds under the new amount you said would receive approximately $54 for every $100 increase in the cap you make. It's essentially the reverse of the ASR, 54%. Students who are in institutions who charge tuition less than the cap amount still receive their same state grant. Their grants are not reduced. So they would receive the same grant they would if you had not changed the tuition and fee cap. In terms of the overall proportion of state grant funds, you will find that the proportion of funds does mirror the tuition and fees charged by the institution. So those institutions who have higher tuition fees charged, their students receive a larger proportion of state grants than those who are at low-cost institutions. And that is the direct result of the formula taking tuition and fees into account.
Representative Lean.
Thank you.
All right. Proceed.
So, Mr. Chair, on slide 19, what this simply shows is what that 46%, what the recognized price of attendance is for whichever institution you have in your packet, and what the 46% means in terms of a dollar amount. In terms of benchmarking that student responsibility, what we can see is this is what the ASR amounts would be for next year at the various campus types. You can see that as tuition fees go up, the ASR also increases, or the proportion we expect students to pay goes up. In terms of benchmarks, we actually compare it to what students can earn or borrow in a given year. So if we were to take the average earnings of Minnesota Work Study students, which is $8.47 an hour, apply that, assume they're working 20 hours per week, at 50 weeks per year, it would be approximately $8,400. If you want to look at it in terms of the federal student loan maximum, what we show is $5,500 is the amount that first-year students can borrow. Third- and fourth-year students can borrow an additional $2,000. So that's how those compare. So the question we always ask ourselves is the assigned student responsibility amounts reasonable for what a student can work or borrow?
Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation, just trying to make sense of it. How is it, like when you look at page 18, where the assigned student responsibility was 50%, and now it's less than that, but yet the student debt is so much higher? I don't quite understand how that works.
Ms. Ferguson.
Mr. Chair and Representatives, the amount that students borrow is actually based on the cost of attendance that institutions report to the U.S. Department of Education. It is not the same cost base that is used for the state grant program. So as long as a student can typically borrow up to their maximum allowable loan amount, okay, or until it reaches cost of attendance. So students frequently will borrow the maximum allowable, which for a third or fourth year senior is $7,500 per year. And when you take the total federal borrowing over a four-year period, it approximately is $27,000 to $28,000. In terms of the Minnesota State Grant Program, we monitor what those federal loan limits are, but I'll go back to what I said before. If the state grant does not reflect the actual tuition and fees that a student is paying, or even the room and board cost that a student is actually paying, 100% of that additional cost is on them. And so a lot of times families will borrow to pay additional costs above and beyond what's covered by the Pell Grant and the state grant.
Representative Johnson. Okay. Proceed. Oh, we have one more. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fergus, I guess I do have one more question. Do you foresee this presenting a situation where a school would say, okay, I know the cap on the grants is going to go up as tuition goes up, so do you foresee a situation coming about where schools are going to say, well, you know, I can just raise tuition because the grant cap is going to go up?
Ms. Fergus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lean, I'm trying to remember how Director Pogemiller phrased this yesterday, or on Monday. We know there is not really a correlation between, for example, the grants students become available for and the tuition fee prices. However, having been on the other side of the equation in assisting universities in developing budgets, it is a factor they probably take into consideration. However, in Minnesota, most colleges, with the exception of Minsky, are already over that cap. So pretty much the only ones who'd be faced with that question, well, in the immediate future, are the Minsky two-year institutions, because they will be over that cap starting next year. So that's the immediate application we see. Most of them are way too far over for it to have much of an effect, from my opinion.
Representative Lee?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's not really a question more than a comment, but I just would see that issue coming about. And I know we had said here the cap is at, I believe, $10,004, and tuition at the Minsky in Moorhead, I believe, is roughly $8,000. So, you know, I just would never want to see a situation, or even for the UM schools for that matter, where they're already over that cap, to say, okay, the state grants are going to catch up, or a Minsky campus saying, you know, well, the cap is already higher, so we can go up a little higher, but that's all. Thank you.
Ms. Ferguson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, the one thing I would add is that because Minsky four-year institutions are under the cap, any tuition and fee increases that occur in that sector are automatically covered by the Minnesota State Grant Program. So that's kind of already built in for that sector.
Ms. Ferguson, how is the viability of the program? There was a period of time where this program was in serious jeopardy. So, alluding to Representative Lean's comments, how stable is this program now?
Mr. Chair, in terms of projecting appropriations out and the overall viability of the program, we believe it's very stable. The design of the program can adapt well to changing circumstances, both economic circumstances such as the last recession, as well as some of the institutional charges that students may see. In addition to the changing federal Pell Grant, we went through an entire study over the last 12 months that will likely finalize later this spring that shows that the rationing statute and the surplus statutes that were put into effect after the last recession provide a lot of flexibility for changing the program if we need and if there's dramatic policy changes at the federal level.
All right, your last statement. If there are dramatic policy changes at the federal level, would it put this program in jeopardy, considering what you're using the program for now?
Mr. Chair, if there's a dramatic policy change at the federal level, the Minnesota State Grant will adjust to protect the lowest income students first, and then whatever other cuts are made to a federal Pell Grant, those are essentially passed on to the student. So Minnesota would continue to do its part, prioritizing lowest income students first, of course, and then with whatever appropriations we have available.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, the second payment responsibility is that of the family. For dependent students, it's assumed that the parents will pay this. For independent students, it's typically the student and the spouse, if there is one. We use the results of the federal need analysis. However, Minnesota believes that the federal needs analysis, or the expected family contribution, parent contribution, and student contribution that students receive after filling out the FAFSA, are largely excessive. And so we reduce those amounts in statute. We only consider 96% of the amount for dependent students, 86% of the amount for independent students with children, and then 68% of the amount for independent students without children. Now, that logic may seem a little bit reverse, but in the federal policy, independent students, if they do not have children, are expected to pay between 40 and 50% of their income towards educational costs. And under Minnesota policy, we believe that percentage of income is a little bit of excessive, to say the least. So we reduce those amounts downward. The federal need analysis does provide some protections in terms of if the student or spouse is working, or if they have children, or if, and we also exclude a lot of major assets such as home equity, home value, and retirement accounts. So those are excluded from any assessment of income or assets. This is how that looks visually. In the model, this is what the actual assessment rates are from the federal need analysis. So for qualifying for a Pell Grant, the first column of percents you see, essentially at the top 30%, if you are an independent student, single and no children, and you earn approximately $50,000, we expect you to contribute 30% of that $50,000 to cover your educational costs. For that's what the federal policy is, 30%. If you are married but no children, it's 23% of that $50,000 in income. If you are a dependent student, we expect your parents to pay 7% of their $50,000 income, and then 6% and 3% if they are independent students, single or married with children. As you go to the higher incomes, those assessment rates continue to rise. At $110,000 in income, it's 37% for a single independent student, which is approximately $40,000. That federal policy expects you to contribute. On the next slide, you can see the reductions Minnesota makes. However, if you look at the orange line again, for a student who is single, no children, earning $50,000 a year, we expect them to contribute 20% of their income towards educational costs, or approximately $10,000 for each year you're enrolled. For the dependent student, again, it's about 7% of that $50,000 in income we expect parents to contribute. At the higher income levels, they still continue to rise, ranging from 13 to 25%. So even after making adjustments, Minnesota expects students to contribute a large amount towards the cost of their education. One of the final parameters we look at is the federal Pell Grant. Currently, federal Pell Grant awards range from They range from $602 to $5,550. The Pell Grant funds do allow the state in flexibility if you want to change a parameter within the program to target state grant funds to a specific group or income range. So this is where the Pell Grant flows in the visual display of the state grant program. And then finally, we have the Minnesota State Grant. So after we get done calculating the entire formula, the state grant is represented by the dark green section. It is the remainder. Whatever costs are not covered by the other payers, based on those assessments, we then pick up through the Minnesota State Grant program. As you can see, the Minnesota State Grant does extend beyond the range of the federal Pell Grant at most institutions. From the office's perspective, we understand that we know that college affordability and student debt is a concern for students, parents, and policymakers. And this is where I'd go back to those multicolored charts. We feel the percent of income required of some families is largely unreasonable. We also know that the program's effectiveness is limited by the fact that we do not cover the actual costs that students incur. So when we're talking about that $10,488, that additional $3,000 is 100% the responsibility of the student, and we know that places a burden on the student and the family.
Ms. Hughes, I'm going to pause you here. We have two students who wish to testify, and it's actually to this point. So if they could come down now and introduce themselves for the record. If they both want to come down, that's great. And I'm not sure which is going first. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski, members of the committee. My name is Steve Sabin, and I am president of the Minnesota State College Student Association, as well as a nursing student at Central Lakes College in Brainerd. MSCSA itself is a student-led organization that represents the over 100,000 public two-year community and technical college students around Minnesota. And our mission is to afford accessible, quality, and affordable public higher education through advocacy and leadership development. Before I address student debt, I'd like to just provide a little bit of context about the affordability of higher education in Minnesota. Currently, Minnesota's public college students pay the third highest tuition and fees in the country, and after taking into account grant and scholarship aid, over half of these colleges are among the highest net costs in the country. There has been much conversation about what has driven this increase, but one thing remains clear. In the past decade, there has been a disinvestment of higher education by the state, which has forced students to bear the weight of achieving a post-secondary education. As students have been forced to shoulder the rising cost of tuition, some alarming trends in student loan borrowing have occurred. In 2010 alone, MSCU's student borrowing increased $117 million, or 19%, and between 2003 and 2010, borrowing has increased 149%. Among MSCU students. These unsustainable trends show a growing dependence by our students on loans and grants to fund their education. This may be especially true for the 56% of MSCU college students who are part-time. Many are working to pay for college and treated inequitably by the Minnesota State Grant Program. I share the experience of many MSCU students that struggle with their debt. I am the first in my family to attend college. I was raised by my grandparents and decided to enroll in college after caring for my ailing grandfather. He was diagnosed with bone cancer, and in caring for him, I came to know several nurses, many compassionate and knowledgeable nurses who helped him. Their work inspired me to pursue a career in nursing, and I completed a diploma in practical nursing, as well as now working on my associate in arts degree. When I graduate, I plan to get a bachelor's degree in nursing, become an RN, and become a critical care nurse and patient advocate. Like the majority of MSCU college students, I had to work through college, sometimes requiring part-time attendance. My wife was also attending nursing classes at Central Lakes College at the same time. While both of our programs required a set amount of credits each semester, we adjusted our schedules to free up enough time to work and focus on our studies. While attending classes, we both worked as nursing assistants at a facility in Brainerd, as well and held the work-study positions at Central Lakes College. We also tried to maximize the amount of state grant funding we would receive. With limits on our work schedule, we relied on student loans and grant funding to afford school. I have borrowed nearly $20,000 to attain my two-year degree, and in total, my wife and I have student loans totaling $50,000. We have tried in every way possible to limit our debt load. While living in Brainerd, we lived in a very small apartment for less than $500 a month. Our entire student loan awards covered our rent costs and utilities. I still remember on every disbursement day, we would go down to the bank and withdraw our entire award disbursement and then divide them up into each month's rent and put them in small little envelopes to make sure that they were secure, our rent was secure for the semester. After we graduated from our programs, we moved back down here to the Twin Cities, where we were forced to live with family to limit the amount of debt that we would take on until we were able to secure jobs. Until recently, we even shared a 14-year-old little Ford Escort to commute between our jobs as we couldn't afford a car payment. We have made financially responsible decisions in order to reduce the significant debt that we would be faced with when our college careers come to an end. My wife and I are now entering our 30s and are looking to, forward to having kids and buying our first house. However, we are faced with the very real possibility that these milestones will need to be delayed because of our massive debt. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate your time and stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sabine. What do you anticipate would be income once you get your degree, if you get the position that your degree is commensurate with? Do you have an idea?
At this time, depending on the positions we would hold, we'd expect our income to be roughly about $50,000 to $60,000.
For each of you?
Together, sorry. Okay. It'd be about $30,000 each.
Okay. We had taken testimony earlier on the size of the debt compared to what you might be earning, and this is an extremely interesting testimony. Sure. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Mariah Miles. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify today. As I said, my name is Mariah Miles. I am a student at Minnesota State University Mankato, majoring in international relations, and I am the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. We are excited to work with you throughout the session to address challenges facing students to better prepare Minnesota for a prosperous future. I'd like to begin by telling you briefly about our organization. The Minnesota State University Student Association represents the seven state universities that include Minnesota State Mankato, Minnesota State Moorhead, Winona State, Bemidji State, Southwest State, Metropolitan State, and St. Cloud State. We are an independent nonprofit funded and operated by students. Currently, we represent over 75,000 students. Debt is one of the major issues on the minds of students across the state. As many of you are aware, the student debt load has risen dramatically over the past decade. Currently, the average student debt load for a graduating student from a Minsky university is $28,566. The dramatic increases in tuition have been in large part caused by a disinvestment by our state. Prior to 1983, the state government paid 80% of the total cost of attendance at a state university. Then, in 1983, the state was faced with a recession and reduced funding to 67% of the total cost for students at a state college or university. State funding remained at 67% mark until 2003, and then over the last 10 years, the state has continued the trend of decreasing funding for higher education, with even deeper cuts than seen on the national average around the country. Today, students are bearing the brunt, as the state only covers 39% of the total cost. This has placed the increased cost of higher education directly on the backs of students. Minsky is now operating with a state appropriation that is close to the same appropriation in real dollars that it received in 2001. How this affects me, I have taken every opportunity presented to me at Minnesota State Mankato to get the most out of my state-sponsored education. I was persistent and determined to graduate, but due to the inflated cost of tuition for my generation, unfortunately, it doesn't matter how well I did in class or how much I've contributed to my community. It doesn't matter that I organized a conference for over 400 students across the state and other states. It doesn't matter how many times I've walked dogs in my community. It doesn't matter how many A's I've gotten. I will still carry my excessive burden of $40,000 after I graduate. As I graduate in May, I have little time to celebrate and feel accomplished. I have circled on my calendar the dates I will have to start paying my tuition or paying my student loans. If I ever thought I'd feel pressure before in my life, it was nothing compared to the fear of defaulting on my student loans. I'm lucky enough to have landed an internship during my undergrad that will turn into a full-time position next fall. This still gives me time during the summer to figure out how to pay for my private student loans that come due immediately. I will certainly be postponing other investments that I have imagined for myself after college. It looks like I will be driving my 1996 Ford Contour for as long as I can. I certainly won't be buying a new car anytime soon, let alone consider buying a house or starting a family. As a 23-year-old college graduate, this is not what I had imagined for my life. However, thankfully, I have a degree from a wonderful Minsk institution. I have talents I know are valuable, and I have a desire to succeed that is unwavering. I have the skills to come here today and be the face of the 75,000 students of Minsku and the students that are in situations not unlike mine to hopefully aid in the process of helping Minnesota remain an incredible place to live and learn. In conclusion, Mr. Chair, I have a quote from an article yesterday that I read by Fox Business columnist, and this just speaks to things that we've been hearing on an almost daily basis. Uh-oh, it's beginning to feel just a little bit like 2006 housing bubble that burst. This time, it's not housing that's growing uncontrollably, it's student loan debt. The trends in student debt should be a concern to all Minnesotans. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Ms. Miles, your degree is in international relations?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell us what you might anticipate a salary should you get a job in that area? Is that, by the way, business or government?
Government.
Okay.
Supposed to be.
If you were elected to the House, I can tell you'd be $33,100. So.
Yes, sir.
$31,000.
I'm sorry, $31,000. Yes, I'm sorry.
That don't grant
I tried to give us a raise, and it doesn't work. The chairman doesn't get any more.
Many of the students in my major aspire to work for government or the United Nations, things like that. But I've been lucky enough to be scouted and going into business. And so I'm most likely going to be earning more out the gate than my peers because I have taken the tools I've learned in class and made them applicable to whatever situation I'm presented with. Many of the students in my classes are extremely talented. They just don't know how to communicate that yet. And I've been lucky enough to be put into situations where I'm challenged to say, you know, what can you do for me Monday morning? How is this experience going to change that? And I've done that through mentors at the university and experiences that I've worked for. So starting salary, I can tell you I'm negotiating my salary right now. I had no idea what I'm doing, but I hope it works out. And they basically told me, we know you're graduating with debt. They don't know it's $40,000 with the debt, but they said figure out what you need and we'll go from there. And I am the only person I know of that has been lucky enough to have that said to them.
You know where MSUSA was founded and by whom?
I should know this. Winona? Mankato?
Yeah. Winona State University by Tim Penny, then Congressman Tim Penny.
Sorry.
I believe he has a special fund for you for internships and other items.
He does.
There's a very nice golf tournament he hosts every summer at the Jewel in Lake City, just in case we want to keep those scholarships moving.
Yes,
just
sir.
Just FYI. I'll probably see you there.
Yes, I will. You'll most likely beat me because I'm terrible at golf. I mostly just like the golf carts, so maybe I'll ride with you and we can talk about higher education.
We appreciate people who don't play just to ride along. That
yes, sir.
Increases the speed of our play dramatically. So, questions? Representative Swazinski.
I'll pass.
All right. Questions to either of the two? Members, we're going to, well, Representative Dorholt has a motion. Thank you both for coming today. Well, extremely well done. Representative Darrell.
Mr. Chair, I move that the minutes March 4th be approved.
Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, we're going to pick up with the office on Monday, but should we conclude with them, we are going to go to the two system requests, university first. We do have people to testify on those two system requests. So I would hope that members would be here. The testimony is going to be to the impact of the system requests and how those budget requests were put together. So hopefully, and save all of this again, next week we get into the most interesting. And we should also have the report on the University of Minnesota and the administration. And as soon as we get it, we're going to share it. And I'm sure you will be asking President Kaler questions on that report. So that's also going to be before us. With that, meeting is adjourned. Thank you.